Law, Policy, and Markets. I'm Alan Marks. Today, I'm joined by Pete Taylor, who is a partner at Carlyle and co-head of the Carlyle Global Infrastructure Opportunity Fund, based in Washington, D.C., along with Dan Seltzer, Managing Director for Project Finance and the Global Corporate and Investment Banking Group at MUFG in New York.
Credit to the Port Authority, their propensity to work all day, all night, all week to help this project get done, as was evidenced at the recent groundbreaking out of JFK. This is a real intergenerational opportunity for the community in Queens and New York as a whole that I'm really pleased to have been part of.
Let's get to it.
Welcome to John F. Kennedy International Airport.
Last month, the governor of New York and myriad other dignitaries gathered for the groundbreaking of the new Terminal 1 at New York's JFK International Airport. The new 2.4 million square foot international terminal will be built in phases on the sites of the current Terminals 1 and 2 and former Terminal 3. New Terminal 1 will be the largest terminal at JFK International Airport and represents an integral part of the $18 billion transformation project for the airport, now well underway. The project is being developed by a consortium led by Carlyle, new operator Ferrovial, Ullico, and JLC Infrastructure, which is a joint venture between Loop Capital and Magic Johnson Enterprises. I had the privilege and pleasure to lead Milbank's team representing the banks that are providing over $6.6 billion in construction loans for the project. In June, the financing for the project closed with construction loans from a group of banks from North America, Asia, and Europe. The airport terminal is expected to provide a world-class passenger experience. It will also create more than 10,000 total jobs, including 6,000 union construction jobs, with over 30% as a goal for minority and women-owned businesses and community and local businesses. Initially expected to break ground in 2020, the severe impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on air travel required that the Port Authority and the new Terminal 1 consortium restructure the previous agreement to build and operate the new terminal. The entire cost of the terminal will be privately financed by the NTO consortium. Today, it is a pleasure to go behind the scenes of the project financing with two of its architects, Pete Taylor, a partner at Carlyle, and Dan Seltzer, a banker and managing director at MUFG, who acted as the financial advisor to the sponsor group. Pete, Dan, thanks very much for taking the time to get together today.
Alan, thanks for having us this morning.
Yeah, thank you, Al.
So first, congratulations are in order to you and your whole teams. It was quite an accomplishment, I think, to get financing done this year for anything in the airports and travel sector, and certainly for any infrastructure project of this size, a $9.5 billion new terminal for international travel at JFK Airport. Pete, first, how will this terminal change the experience for travelers going from New York through JFK to overseas destinations?
The initial need was for those who travel through current Terminal 1 at JFK, I think it's got a nameplate design, less than 2 million passengers per annum. And pre-COVID, it was running more than 4 million. And, for the passenger, it was the congested experience as you arrived. It was a congested experience as you checked in, went through security. There was really no retail experience from a airport operator, terminal operator's perspective. You missed the commercial opportunity. And then if you just so happen to be waiting to board an A380 headed to Europe or Asia, or even a large wide-bodied aircraft, there wasn't adequate room, wasn't adequate hold room. And then at the same time, when you arrived, it was like, welcome to the United States. Would you please stay in the basement for a while as you wait for customs and border? So, one of the first drivers was really, there was an enormous need for completely changing the customer experience, which is really was the drive of Governor Cuomo back with redevelopment of JFK as a whole.
So what were the drivers for the new terminal to be delivered as a P3 or a public-private partnership?
One was obviously that customer experience, both for people who fly and as well as for airlines. There is a significant demand for airlines to either service the New York market from an origin or destination perspective. That was a key driver. And then the second one, and it was really interesting to work with the Port Authority and do this as a P3, was how did you craft a P3? How did you ensure that this was a net contributor of value to the Port Authority versus an availability style P3? So understanding that and being able to deliver something that met their needs economically and across stakeholders was important. And the third was, we really sort of related to the first one, If you fly into JFK, you're waiting for wing walkers to come out and wave you in. You're kind of hoping your bags turn up. And if there's a bad storm like there was in 2018, you probably saw your bag sitting under an air bridge, you know, in the snow because they couldn't sort it. So inadequate capacity. The third leg of it was, you know, what was the opportunity for the community? And as we looked at the airport, instead of having a job at the airport where you might have moved bags or been a wing walker, what was the opportunity to really have a career in airport operations as we moved, as I describe it, from kind of the VHS world that we operate airports in the US through to the Netflix world, which is highly digital, highly integrated, coordinated operating center, integrating the terminal, the ramp out into the broader airfield operations. So if I go to 30,000 feet, thinking about, you know, what was the client opportunity, which is the Port Authority in the state of New York and the city of New York, you know, what was the customer opportunity for passengers and airlines? And then what was this real community opportunity? And for us, that encapsulated, you know, how do you have this, not just as kind of a token net contributor to the community, but really drive the opportunity for people to have careers in airport operations, as well as opportunities for minority and women-owned businesses.
Dan, in looking at how this gets funded, obviously, you know, this deal started before the pandemic and then obviously had, like everything else in the market, to deal with those challenges, but they were particularly acute for large international airports. How does air traffic fit in and projections of air traffic fit into a transaction like this?
Yeah, it's a great question, Alan. I think it's really essential for both the equity side and for the debt side as well. But I think that the reason why this deal was such a success had a lot to do with the fact that this is JFK and it's tied to the New York story. Not to be disparaging about any of the other big, large hub airports that we have in the States or around the world, but I think that, you know, because this was New York, we were able to weather, you know, the pandemic and weather different, you know, aviation industry factors throughout the duration of this conception and development plan. I don't think other airports or other hubs would be able to do that. So I really think it speaks to the critical nature of JFK, about New York as a hub for aeronautical traffic. And the fact that, look, when you look historically throughout other shock events, setting aside COVID, JFK has always rebounded really quickly, be it the GFC, be it the September 11th events, be it other macroeconomic events. You've seen aviation drop, but then you've seen the numbers return pretty quickly. So I think it's really about the resiliency of the marketplace and the airport that were really critical factors in getting people comfortable.
And obviously, you know, people talk about transactions versus relationships. The idea being a transaction is one-off and there's something, you know, economic or commercial. But this really is an example of relationship building, where people have to listen to each other, care about what each other have to want, and in some cases, you know, their apprehensions or fears about what might go wrong. So, Pete, as you were redoing the terms of this deal and maintaining and enhancing the relationships you had with the Port Authority among the sponsor and equity consortium, and of course, with on the construction side, with the trades, with the community, and then with the financing sources, how do you keep all those balls in the air when you're dealing with a global pandemic?
It's really good that you raised that, Alan. We basically, prior to the pandemic and through the pandemic, as you know, we saw the vaccines coming out, we could see that it was going to have the desired effect of ameliorating the impact of the pandemic. Really thinking about how do you get everybody over the line, whether it's the partners we had in the deal, our other equity partners, the transition we did to Ferrovial, how did we work with the port, how did the port work with the city on the lease extension? Working through all those and making sure everybody was getting to a position that worked for them was a challenge. And there were days when, you know, it looked nigh impossible and we'd figure out another way to solve something.
Pete, we've talked before about the four corners of the deal. What are some specific examples? Because you've got the airlines, you know, the economics of it, we've got supply chain financing, and then, of course, this whole stakeholder range of issues around the Port Authority and policy or politics and the unions and the community.
But yeah, just to give you a couple of highlights of that, and I talk about four corners or four legs. You know, one, you know, to Dan's point, you've got this fantastic origin destination market in New York. It's got a large O&D component. You've got airlines that flow in. But, you know, the pandemic had a really prolonged and significant impact on our airline partners. And, you know, as we look through that, you know, we had to, and it got them to change their strategic direction. You know, Japan Airlines decided it was a one-world airline. It was going to Terminal 8. we could see things playing out in different directions. But working through at the airlines, and in the end, to Dan's point, we fundamentally came back and said, there is a demand that's going to come back through. We don't know when, we don't know the shape of recovery, but there's a demand that's going to come back through because it's such a strong origin destination market. And so through the pandemic, you know, our commercial development team, led by Ahmed Ricky, really got out on the road and engaged with airlines that were really seeking access to the New York market, were prepared to commit. And we had to reconfigure our whole airline group. So that's kind of the airline group, and which represent customers. So I mean, airline tails change, but you're really thinking about what airlines are going to serve customers. We had to reposition all of that. We had to make sure it was economic. And I think that took us a long while. Because they were suffering such losses, they just couldn't see how they could, you know, how could they justify committing to a terminal on an economic basis. And I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, as we saw inflation and we saw in the post-COVID world, you know, just cost escalation that can make that work. The second corner of that was really kind of an input was, you know, how did you deal with design build? I mean, through 2020, 2021, we saw a lot of supply chain. We didn't really know what design builder, and we ended up putting this out for a competitive tender again. But the design builders were trying to think about how could they ensure that they can meet schedule, because liquidated damages were significant, as well as the cost inputs, both labor and commodity and materials inputs, and get certainty in an uncertain market with supply chain. So a lot of conversations there, and we had to really work with two design build consortiums. We ultimately selected a Tishman AECOM consortium, but we had to work with both and listen to them as to the challenges. And then we take the challenges they brought to us, think about how that interfaced with our third leg, which was really the financing on the debt and equity across ratings, bond markets, bank markets, you know, and rating agencies per se, and how would they intersect. And then the fourth leg, which was the Port Authority and the government agencies, you know, how do we get that four legs and three-dimensional chess the whole time to work and make sure everybody got to a position where they were prepared to commit? And in essence, all of them prepared to commit to a four-way partnership that would work for everybody. Everybody had to take on risk to get there, but how would they commit? And for the port, that meant going back and having to negotiate a lease extension with the city of New York, and then also really bring a public policy perspective to all the conversations. You know, we'd been awarded the rights to the development pre-COVID. We were coming back and kind of negotiating in additional terms. And one of the traps we could have fallen into is we just kept asking for everything we needed, and we had to stop and think, actually, what did they need so they could justify giving us what we need? How did that intersect with airlines? Did we need to change airline combination? And how did that work with our design, build, procurement? So getting the four of them to solve, and each of those legs had multiple parties underneath it. So, for example, you know, really important to maintain public support for the Port Authority's approach was commitments to labour participation. So all credit to the trades in the New York region. Their commitment to a project labour agreement was phenomenal. How do we commit to hiring both people and committing to subcontractors in zip codes, our commitment to MWBE. So they were important financial and non-financial aspects for the port. Had to bring that back. How did that work with the design build? How would that work in their ability to take on the risk we needed to interface with financing and ratings and equity? And then how did that work for the value proposition we had to give to the airlines?
So as if it wasn't hard enough for us to do this when we started in 2018, you know, you had to get everybody back together again to sort of reinvent things. I guess kind of a do-over, you know, like when Moses comes down with the second set of tablets after the first one has been shattered and they get a chance to try again. What was the difference between the first and the second attempts?
So that was really it was complex enough pre-COVID. And as I joke, we enjoyed doing it the first time so much with Dan and you, Alan, that we decided to do it twice. But it really had to bring out, and we would do it, we would a lot of times reflect on, it's not what they can't give us what we're asking for. What are they needing? What were other ways? And what were the combination of pieces we had to put together to get to their landing? And
so, you know, P3s are about shared risk, about, you know, private and public, about debt and equity. Air traffic ordinarily is a risk. It's something you can model, you can predict with, you know, probabilities depending on your economic assumptions. It's very different than uncertainty, you know, like pandemic or a war and so forth. So in the middle of this pandemic, to come back and then reattempt to model air traffic and costs and supply chains and everything else that goes into this, obviously you need, you know, more runway, if you pardon the pun. And the Port Authority lease with New Terminal 1 is an issue. The ground lease the Port Authority had with the City of New York needed to be extended. You know, what are some examples of how you dealt with that?
You know, I'll give you a great example of that. With respect to the lease extension, the two key concerns are if we have a real snapback in traffic, could we make basically returns in excess of what we should have for the risk we took? And so working out economic sharing and recovery mechanisms with the port was a key piece of negotiation. One of the issues we faced is, you know, from a public policy perspective, you know, they were concerned they didn't want a repeat of what happened at Terminal 8, where, as you all know, there's that big wall, the whole of Terminal 8 didn't get built. Ultimately, if the traffic's there, they want the whole of New Terminal 1 built. We, with Dan, were working with rating agencies opposite you, Alan, with the banks, and we're like, hang on, everybody can see the case for building the existing capacity. So how do we bifurcate the growth in the terminal as a credit issue versus an equity issue? How do we take that back into our design, build contracting strategy to get efficiencies out of it? And actually, how do we make that work with the port? So, you know, just a couple of examples of complex issues we had to work through on multiple levels.
All right. So kind of breaking down how that plan changed, and maybe Dan, you can give us a description of it. You know, the original project, which would replace the existing Terminal 1 as well as Terminal 2 and the footprint from where Terminal 3 used to stand, is now being built in phases. And I think that staging was an important part of, you know, aligning first the project needs for what the Port Authority needed and what the airlines needed for the, you know, the expected future growth in air traffic, which, you know, is that whole, the curve always slopes up to the right, right? But you don't know where it starts, you don't know the slope. So it's going to might shift over to the right. It might be a little different. So I think they were adjusting that and allowing flexibility basically to react as that changed. And also then not overbuilding and having too high a construction price up front, especially, you know, in the current environment. So how is the staging now between the, you know, phases A, B1, B2. Can you explain that a bit?
It's really about risk balance, and it's risk balance for all the participants. And really what the concept is now is that rather than building one large terminal, is that the terminal will be built in phases. You'll have the initial set of gates along with the head house built on the empty parcels of Terminal 3, which is completely vacant, used as a parking lot these days. And Terminal 2, which is Delta Domestic, is going to be demolished as well. And that will be part of the initial phasing. Subsequent phasing will move to where the existing Terminal 1 building is today. And that will represent the western piers of the terminal when it's all fully built out. But I think the phasing concept, which was really implemented post-COVID because of some of the uncertainties, as Pete calls it, the snapback of when air traffic would come, is really about finding a balance. And I think that it was a prudent measure by all the parties at the table to kind of take these steps to say, look, let's make sure we have that snapback really manifest the way we're anticipating. And I think the consultants and the markets and the rating agencies were all kind of coalescing around the fact that traffic was expected to rebound back to 2019 levels in 2024. And so is that the right point to kind of say, look, are we going to implement some sort of metric to say, look, if we are really getting back to that metric, then we should mobilize the full concept of the terminal as we envisioned originally, the 23 gates. And so does that make sense? But given how costs have moved because of the dislocation in the logistics chain and just because of pricing that's really risen because of inflationary pressures, what was conceptualized as the initial construction price had moved substantially during the COVID period. And so I think rather than have everybody be on the hook for potentially overbuilding and incurring excess costs that didn't really have a matching revenue stream to it, I think prudency dictated that everybody be on risk at appropriate levels. And I think that was the right thing to do. And it obviously something that was well received by the rating agencies, it was well received by the bank market, and I think will play out well eventually when we access the capital markets as well.
And when you look at the construction risks, and maybe Pete, I'll come back to you on this, you know, there's this, stepping back from the JFK Terminal 1 project and looking at the market more broadly, there's this conversation around how, when supply chains are disrupted, when schedules become longer, who owns the float, right? When labor is, especially skilled labor in construction trades, is scarce in many markets, there's this shift of risk between owners or sponsors on one side and builders or designers on the other. And these are complicated projects to put together. They take a long time. And over that time period, supply chains can be disrupted. You can get inflation. It may be, maybe you can lock in prices early on for some materials, but maybe there's, you know, there's too much expense to do so. And there's this move, say, to more progressive design build contracting structures, guaranteed maximum price versus fixed price and so forth. How do you see that trend playing out? And as someone who puts together these projects for a living and invests in them for a living, what concerns you?
I do think the classical model from early on in our careers in the industry, which was full lump sum allocation to a design builder, I do think that model's just not going to be feasible going forward on projects of scale, whether it's the scale of schedule, scale of cost. But also importantly on that was a really important interface we had through thinking through that with respect to what was the design parameters that we needed operationally to meet my earlier comments about what was going to be the passenger experience, what was the commercial opportunity. So what we're finding is in the migration to that, and it's done a lot in real estate, is more across to progressive guaranteed maximum price. So stepping away first from lump sum to guaranteed maximum price, a lot more collaboration because there's operational outcomes we want as owners and operators. There's cap that the design builder wants to have exposure to. A lot more collaboration. And as you progress, design and the buyout of the job through subcontractors, there are elements of risk that are going to be left as jointly held. And I'll say not between the project and the design builder, but between equity and the design builder. I do think there's an ability to do progressive guaranteed maximum price contracts. You know, we got ratings on that basis. We ultimately were able to progress design to a level where you could do a single GMP. But I do think the market's going to move where a lot more projects are going to get to notice to proceed or final investment decision on a progressive GMP basis. The progressive risk is going to be owned jointly or some share between equity and the design builder. It's going to require additional equity capital in it. And I think that's one, especially in a public-private environment like what we're doing here, because we all risk manage, you're going to have to share then if there's benefit capture between the design builder equity and the agency, the public agency per se. But look, that I can see that trend moving across. It's difficult. It's a real challenge as we get into the rating structure, and Dan can comment more on this. But it was relatively new for some agencies, some other agencies that had more experience on it. But really going through and thinking about through construction, not all risk is equal. So if we go back over a long period of doing this, and Alan and Dan, you've done them for a long period, you know, the major risk is actually getting down into the ground, getting back up out of the ground, getting your horizontal infrastructure done, and then the key elements of your vertical infrastructure. But it's a really important credit piece, which in addition to how do we think about staging that Dan just highlighted from a traffic perspective, it was also how do we think about staging and parceling up the construction risk, because it's not just one large piece of construction risk. Dan, I'd be interested in your credit perspectives on that. We work very closely on it, but that was a key thread the needle, and it's definitely the emerging trend.
Yeah, Dan, in the credit markets, both for the banks, credit committees, but also for the rating agencies, how did they look at that?
No, it was a critical point and definitely something we were seeing in the marketplace before the project really started, and we were thinking about the risk profile. But, you know, I think the size and scale of this project really kind of left you with a small handful of developers who, A, could do the work, and B, had the balance sheets really to support it. Pete is right, though. I think as we thought about it, it was really, where are the milestones and where are your big expenses and where are you most at risk in terms of dollars to be spent? And along that S curve, where are lenders going to be most vulnerable if you have to start replacing parties and do so at a premium, and all the typical analysis that you typically see for projects becomes even more of a showcase on something of this size. So I think that the fact that we had to think about it from a different context to say, look, while we're going to strive towards getting a fixed price to de-risk lenders about the construction, we did have to think about alternative to say, what's the right mix of being on risk ourselves as an equity group and therefore also sharing some of that risk with the lenders, but also how do we try to mitigate some of that risk about the big elements like curtain wall and steel and pylons and all the activity in markets that had some volatility.
And how did the rating agencies look at that?
What we found was that for some rating agencies, it was a completely new concept. For others, it wasn't. They had seen this before. I think the overarching sense was, given the environment that we were in, where costs were rising and labor was shrinking, I think all the rating agencies were really willing to listen and be helpful as they thought about what we were trying to propose as alternatives, which was really beneficial for us, just to, so we understand where the limitations of the market are. Look, you don't run into deals of this size very often, but I think the fact that, you know, everybody was willing to be innovative and think about it in a different way was just helpful for our cause. Because as Pete said, I don't think there was really a path to get this done otherwise.
Right. And of course, you know, construction costs, the cost of steel, the cost of labor, materials, that's the thing that really moves the needle. There is another cost, not as important, but certainly still critical, and that's the cost of capital. And I know, Pete, as you know, we were going through this together, 2019, money is still historically, you know, cheap because interest rates are low. They would come even lower with the pandemic and buckets of fiscal monetary support poured in to prevent a depression happening when demand collapsed at the beginning of COVID-19, not just in the US, but in other countries. So there you're in an environment where money is even cheaper, but, you know, we've got these other challenges because of needing to restructure or reorganize the contracts and the plans for the project to deal with this challenge to forecast both the revenues and costs going forward and the air traffic and things that are associated with that. Now we enter late 2021, 2022. Besides inflation, we're starting to see increases in interest rates. Money looks like it's going to cost more. More true at the short end of the curve. Long-term rates have obviously not gone up as much, so that curve is flattened. It was even inverse for a few periods while we were doing this deal. How do you manage finding that optimum window when all the stars align and you're able to close not just your commercial deal and your construction and notice to proceed, but also to obviously line up the capital to pay for it all while interest rates are going up and there's that uncertainty?
Alan, it's a great question. And, you know, traditionally airport terminals in the US have been done as just a large, you know, municipal issuance tax exempt at notice to proceed. That's a US phenomenon, not a global phenomenon. If I look at US energy markets and large energy projects have done that have been associated with, you know, they're kind of done as a bank to bond strategy, and airports globally have got bank financing. And you know, the one thing of being a principal on the investing side the last 20 plus years, I've been through a lot of credit cycles, and I've seen where markets for different reasons are illiquid. And so having access to all markets and really thinking through not a set and forget capital structure, but being able to manage the liability and equity side of your balance sheets. So back in, you know, early 2018, working with Dan and folks, as you remember, you know, we pulled together a bank group. Port Authority had never seen a bank deal per se like this. And we pulled it together because we said the way to manage the risk on the liability side of the balance sheet for the project was really to have access to multiple markets at once. So we pulled together a bank group. We looked at the math, looked at flexibility, and we said, hey, this is just like a large energy project and it'd been well supported in the bank market. Let's do the construction as a bank, and then let's go to the capital markets, both through the tax exempt. Kind of roll that forward. And the reason I said that scene, roll that forward to 2020, late 2021, especially in the 2022, where we were seeing, you know, spread volatility, we were seeing rate volatility, we were seeing inner market liquidity volatility. Having that flexibility to flex between markets, thinking about timing, but having the bank group set up, the joke in the sector is, you know, it's the most credit approved deal someone's ever done because we've done it multiple times. But having that flexibility, bringing people along with the credit story, constantly engaging with banks and rating agencies and also capital markets investors, you know, one of the key reasons why that interaction with capital markets, the banks ultimately want to know that this is an asset the capital markets are interested in. So we did that. Kind of fast forward, you know, Dan and I thought, no issues, we're getting through. We've just brought Ferrovial in as a partner. You know, we've kind of done a step up in capacity that we've brought to the sponsor. We're just going to do the financing. And as you'll recall, heading into early Q2 2022, we were starting to see uncertainty and a lot of volatility in the rate market. We were seeing the fixed rate market really struggle with liquidity. And so very quickly in 2022, we could see this window where, consistent with what we've seen in credit cycles before, the fixed rate market was going to become illiquid. We weren't going to get the volume. We weren't going to get any near the pricing we needed. So we very quickly pivoted with our banks who knew the credit and said, actually, we need to reprice this deal. We want a full five-year construction loan. So construction period plus kind of circa 12 months. We will pay people to own this paper versus paying for this to be a bridge to bond. And so quickly pivoting on that in 2022 helped us solve the credit end. because our assessment was, as banks go up through their credit process, someone senior is going to say, what's the capital markets look like? You're going to get taken out on the bridge. And we were like, look, we need to buy time to execute capital markets. That was really well received. We priced it to own, so that people wanted to own the paper.
You priced a bank piece, so you know they're willing to own the paper, as you say, you know, for the construction debt. But the bank mini perm is still a bridge to a bond takeout long term. How do you solve that?
So we kind of solved one half of the equation, which was, did we have adequate debt capacity at a spread that was economic? The second one was, how do we deal with rate uncertainty, which was a critical issue for ratings and banks and even capital markets investors. You know, as we've looked at the yield curve and, you know, you look at the volatility we've even seen in the last half of September, the drastic 20 basis points a day type volatility across the curve. Yeah, that was our second issue to solve. And as we spent time on that, we really thought about, we do need some certainty because we've got this airline equation, we've got this port equation, we do need certainty. So working with our financial advisors and others and the banks, we worked through an interest rate hedging program that was a proxy for what if we had bank debt for the entirety of the project. How do we put in an interest rate hedging program, adequate breaks and everything else? And then how did you use that as a mitigant to bridge between a bank deal and a bond deal that could be 2 years down the road, could be 4 years down the road, or it could be multiple tranches over multiple years? We did a lot of work on that front. And look, we'd had a lot of bad luck on this deal, and then we made our own luck on timing, as Alan, as you and Dan know, we pushed hard on timing. Because we didn't know where the market was heading. We had gone to the agencies. We'd always gone to agencies and banks with rates that were higher than where market was and everything else to build ourselves some flexibility. Our hedging program and the bank's knowledge of the credit propensity to move at on a quick pace allowed it to get us done right at the cusp of when inflation took off. And I think we really would have struggled if our underlying rates were 50 points higher. But Dan, you came with me over that journey and we're a fantastic partner on it. I think you'd echo the comments, but you know, interested in your other insights because you caught the questions day to day from banks and capital markets as to where we were.
Thanks, Pete. I appreciate that. I think the key for our success is the fact that, look, we were always had a spotlight on the credit story, right? And we made sure that the credit story was coherent and consistent across whatever iteration we had of the deal going on. But I think it's the fact that not only did we have that credit story solid and it made sense from different perspectives, but we were engaged, as Pete said, with the rating agencies who were really, really helpful for us throughout the duration and us kind of going to them with, you know, as the deal continued to evolve, here's what we're doing now and here's why it works. And here's, given the interest rate environment, why it makes sense. And similarly, I think the bank group that we had, we were really fortunate because once they really got an understanding of the credit story and what we were trying to accomplish here, and again, back to my point about the essentiality of JFK, which I think was germane to what they were doing and really underpinned all of their credit analysis, they really were supportive of what we were trying to do throughout the roller coaster that we saw of the economic volatility. We were really fortunate in terms of our timing at the end about when we executed things like the hedges, because we did it on a day where the market was down. And then I think the next successive 10 days, the market had been up, right? That's a real cost on a project of this size. You know, every basis point has a real dollar value. And when you're, you know, talking about $6.6 billion of financing that we ended up undertaking, that's a real meaningful cost. So timing the market right, but having everybody aligned and having the rating agencies be as supportive as they were, I think that was critical to why we were able to be successful. But I think there was always an eye about what are the things that could really make this go upside down. You just never know how markets are gonna react and when they're gonna react. So you do the best that you can and you try to be in a position where you have the luxury of time on your side, but you can't buy time. So you have to just go with it as best you can. Ultimately, like you cost of capital really was something that we had to be careful of throughout the duration of the project. But I would say also, interestingly, I think it was a great lesson for the port, just to Pete's point, you know, the port had never done a bank deal and the muni market was always where these terminals had been financed before. I think it was a great demonstration to them about the power of the project finance market, how banks are willing to lend into construction and understand construction risk, how they're willing to look at and understand ramp-up risk and some of the operational risk with a view towards capital markets takeout. And we had looked across the muni market, the taxable market, which I do think will be there at some point for the eventual takeout.
Right. So the future takeout will be in the bond market. But, you know, just to ask, though, because this is private debt of the concession company under a P3 structure. It's not a traditional bond, muni bond financing by the Port Authority itself. Did the Port Authority appreciate the flexibility that this bank to bond construction financing provided?
It was a great demonstration to the port about alternative markets and how they think about credits like this and their approach and their willingness to really be supportive of strong credit stories. And maybe that's something that will come to play as the port thinks about other projects in the future.
Dan, let me stay with you for 1 second on that too, because one of the things with the banks stepping up to commit to over $6.6 billion of debt is they had to have confidence that they could syndicate some of that down to additional banks, which they were, you know, very successful in doing, given the strength of the project. How much of that is because banks are so well suited to taking on the risk you mentioned, construction risk, ramp up risk? I will add, by the way, because of the long-term hedges that were put in place, that also helps with the refinancing risk because, you know, you've taken some of that interest rate volatility out of the equation. How are banks so much better at figuring that out? I mean, we know the answer to the question, but not everybody listening will.
Yeah, it's an age-old question that's been around for a while. Is it better to finance construction in the bank market versus the bond market? And I do think that the banks are willing to allow for monthly draws. They work with the sponsors and they work with the consultants and really understand when and if there are issues in construction. And they're willing to look and say, is this something that we think that's going to be long-term or just a temporary issue? Can we structure around it and put in place some other mechanisms that get people comfortable during whatever periods of difficulty that there may be? And I've seen that over my career. And I think that really is some of the value that the banks bring to the table. From a capital perspective in the market, I think that there's an abundance of capital for a great deal like this one. And I think that there is a willingness, because there's also a relationship angle as well. But I think there's just a fundamental understanding of construction and good credits and what that ramp up story looks like that makes banks pretty well suited.
Dan, I was going to add 2 points on that. One of the key benefits of the bank market here versus a fixed rate bond market is you can isolate the curve risk away from the credit story. So if you're a municipal bond buyer, you're buying a credit story as well as the curve risk. And one of the things we saw coming into this year was curve risk was really creating a contagion effect into that. And so the banks, we can isolate that. You know, banks are basically lending you to you on a floating rate basis on an agreed spread and all the points Dan highlighted. I also think, look, they look probably at less credits. They're not trying to buy and put in the draw as much so they could work through it. I think the other thing to the syndication, to Dan's point, working through and being ahead on the banks on what do we think the questions were they were going to get asked internally upstairs, things that we migrated from other sectors, other structures, we'd seen to enhance the credit, things like the spring liquidity reserve that I know the agencies wrote about. Our focus on liquidity, how do we demonstrate the resilience, the strength of partners. There's a lot of things we thought about, but a macro point would be separating the curve risk because the banks allocate that across their interest rate derivative desks. Separating that out, I think, actually helped, create a lot of opportunity. But to Dan's point, and we've seen this outside the airport sector, their ability to do project finance across projects that have been built, think through issues, they can be much more bespoke on how they think about stuff. And because this needed syndication, we needed to make sure it really sat well with kind of peers globally. And I think having a global bank group versus the US meant that there were pretty much lenders in every major lending jurisdiction that were prepared to participate in the loan was critical. And then the strength of the sponsors, Carlyle plus Ferrovia, complemented by JLC and Ulico, really gave us a reach and relationship banks that helped. But I, that'd be my two additional points. But yeah, Alan, you were on the other side of that. how was that portrayed at your end?
No, actually, I think it's a fair question. I think that certainly banks can manage these risks because in part they have the resources to assess them, but in part because they're also engaged. I mean, the terms, the covenant packages, the terms of a bank deal, there's communication, there's monitoring, there's oversight, there's collaboration, really. You know, a strong agent and a strong bank group can help to reduce some of those risks if they arise, if there's uncertainties in a process. Going out to get consents, with a large group of bondholders or noteholders, it's a very difficult thing to do, which is one reason why their covenant packages tend to be a little lighter. And it makes more sense for that capital to come in once you've de-risked, in particular, taking the construction risk and the ramp-up risk out of the equation. Because now the cliche is you're clipping a coupon, you're clipping a bond. Well, that's true, because really a lot of the risks have been removed, and that makes sense for a long-term investor to take on that risk. So Pete, when you look at the luck in a way, but also the skill of getting this project done in the window when you did, since then, it's only been a few months, but since then, we're already seeing increases in interest rates further. We're seeing, as a result, I think, not just on, the cost of debt capital, but we're seeing a challenge for long-term valuations of equity because, you have a higher discount rate on your future cash flows if you've got higher interest rate environments that are expected to continue longer term. And construction costs are continuing to go up because inflation appears to be pretty stubborn, at least for now. If you had not been able to close this deal in the summer of 2022, and this were going to be dripping into a very congested year end for a lot of project financings trying to tap into the markets, or worse, into next year, would the deal look the same? Would it still get done the same way?
Would have had to have changed. It was interesting. There's an old adage, time kills all deals. In COVID, it wasn't just COVID. It was then all the secondary and tertiary effects that came through. And it was really proof that time is not your friend. So, we had to make what I would say bold decisions as we came through. They weren't right or wrong, but we looked at if we didn't make that decision, could we stand where we were? And what really transpired, and what's really transpired since we closed, is that there are macro and geopolitical events that are constantly happening in the market that you cannot control. And so you really have to drive the windows to closing that you can. You have to understand and have strength of relationships with all parties in the project as a whole to get things done. But time, and it was a good example, like we were coming through COVID, we thought we were fine, and we get to late last year, we get inflation taking off, okay? We go from inflation to the next variant of COVID, which was highly contagious that most of us managed to pick up through the period through Christmas. And then we get out the other side of that, we kind of pause the bank deal a little at that time, we're like, it's great, then all of a sudden we've got Ukraine. And what it taught us was time in the world we're in right now with macro and geopolitical is not our friend. So you have to drive the closing. Driving the closing means you have to take courageous decisions. And, they're decisions that you can get wrong. I remember talking to a CEO of one of the Wall Street banks, and he said, look, I make eight or 10 decisions, big decisions every year. If I get more than half, two thirds right, I'm doing really well. We didn't get every decision right. But in the end, we wouldn't be closed. We'd be trying to figure out how to get it closed if we hadn't made courageous decisions. And because of our understanding of the four corners, always having this map and understanding of the four corners, I think Dan would highlight and he'd say to people, we really had the ability to understand the credit lens. We didn't go to them blindly with our ask. We knew what they would need. We've all done enough in our careers to understand what they need. We knew what the contractor needed. We knew what the airline, we knew what the port needed. We just drove it time-wise because I just can't tell you what's the next geopolitical or macro event around the corner. And I think that's a big thing. And look, even since inflation, just the energy crisis in Europe and the impact it's having, I think there's less bank appetite in the market than there was when we syndicated this. And so there's always things you'd love to get all your decisions right. We didn't get them all right, but we made decisions, and courageous ones at times, that allowed us to get to the closing. And then we just drove, Alan, as you know, we just drove relentlessly to close. There was no time of day that was off limits to the entirety of the consortium. And credit to the Port Authority, their propensity to work all day, all night, all week to help this project get done was evidenced at the recent groundbreaking out of JFK. This is a real intergenerational opportunity for the community in Queens and New York as a whole that, I'm really pleased to have been part of.
Yeah. Well, congratulations again. I think it was just a real landmark accomplishment. It's been great getting the inside story, by the way, from both of you today. Thank you very much for taking the time to get together.
I appreciate it, Alan. A lot of fun.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Alan. This is great.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Law, Policy, and Markets, Milbank Conversations. Follow us on your favorite podcast platform and learn more at milbank.com.